Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld. Each week I bring people to this program who I feel are really at the leading edge of a spiritual revolution that's happening and seems to be popping up everywhere. Eckhart Tolle and Oprah Winfrey just had 11 million people watching them on the internet, and I think a whole movement in opening up that to people in this culture and around the world that we are more than our bodies, that we have access to other energies that we haven't been educated to be aware of, and that we're much more incredible than we ever could imagine. And my guest tonight is someone who's studied many different spiritual traditions. He's going to be talking about his practice and his traditions. His name is Oscar Sue. Oscar, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Alan.
I know you've studied Chinese, Tibetan, some Hindu too. Can you give me a little background, basically, on where your spiritual practice began?
Actually, it began with my family.
Uh-huh.
My father and my mom both were devout and very devoted Christians.
Uh-huh.
And they took me to church when I was young, along
where
with my
Where was
sister.
That? In this country?
Yes, it was in California, in the Pasadena area.
Uh-huh.
It was a Chinese church, a Baptist church. And I remember looking at my father one day in service, and How Great Thou Art was being sung by the congregation.
Uh-huh.
And he had tears in his eyes. And for my father, that was a unique thing. I think generally in Asian culture, men are not, encouraged to show emotion.
Mm.
And, for me as a child, seeing my father cry, in a very public place, indicated that he was being moved by something.
Mm.
And clearly, it had something to do with the song.
Right.
So that made me kind of want to think about it, at least, and maybe investigate or look at what could it be that would touch my father's heart. So,
how old were you then?
Yeah. I would say I was probably 15, somewhere around 15. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it was an awakening of your emotions as well when you saw your father be so emotional. Did something awaken in you, or were you always pretty sensitive?
Well, I think I'm the kind of person that tries to be attuned to people, and especially, people that are in my life.
Right.
I had always felt like that I was very bonded to my mother.
Uh-huh.
And that there was a certain distance between my father and I. Mm-hmm. But he was always sort of a mentor that came in at certain times in my life to impart wisdom, just sort of out of the blue. I never really expected it when he delivered it.
Mm.
And so I had the kind of relationship where I think the son wanted to have, maybe more of a bond and more of a closeness with his own father. And
so,
that touched me to see him cry.
Uh-huh, right. So then your next stage of development came when? So you're Christian.
I basically was asked, it came throughout high school. I, studied the Bible because I was asked by the pastor's son to, explore the Bible with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very, impressed with Jesus' words. So, for the rest of that time, I just basically decided that I would investigate as much as I could.
Right.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, no, I'm following you. Yeah, I'm with
you.
Yeah.
And through that process, I came to, feel like, a couple things happened. One, I started running out of coherent information to give me a sense of the original Christianity. I was very interested in what Jesus' direct teachings were to his disciples.
Mm-hmm.
And then somewhere in college, I began to have, you know, various, like, Christian mystic experiences, like the descent of the Holy Spirit for 3 days.
What was that like? What you just don't brush over that. What was that whole thing? What happened?
I was experimenting with a technique of, you know, intuitively trying to, with my voice, when I was in prayer,
mm-hmm.
inflect it both mentally and with my intention and with the sound, so that these were all integrated and coherent.
Mm-hmm.
The triune or three aspects of, you know, divine or God's power, God's wisdom, God's love, you know,
mm-hmm.
with a specific prayer. I think it was an invocation of the invocation of the sacred fire, something like that.
And then
actually,
what happened? Yeah.
I felt like a bubble expanded somewhere around me, somewhere from me, but then around me.
Mm-hmm.
And that all of a sudden within that space, there was a sacred space. It was not just like something that was like an emotional quality.
Mm-hmm.
It was more like another dimension had opened, and it enfolded
yeah.
me, you know?
I know what you mean. I've had those, like a mist almost comes in, like the reality is actually distorted or altered somehow. Is that
mm-hmm.
what you saw? Yeah.
Yeah, I felt like reality, that I was in a separate space.
Yeah.
That within that space, you know, there was its own reality,
yeah.
and then there was the reality that was outside. And
and that lasted
holy.
For 3 days?
It lasted for 3 days. I mean, the mental thoughts, the impressions that came to me at that time was, you know, keep silence.
Mm-hmm.
Do not interact with other people. You know, if you want to keep this for as long as you can, mm-hmm. you're going to have to not really get involved with, you know, ordinary conversation and ordinary, you know, thought patterns. So just sort of, you know, stay by yourself and don't really go out into the outside world.
Oh, very
interesting. Into the street.
So that happened, and that shifted you again to another level. And then when did you start to tune into the Eastern spirituality?
I, you know, felt, you know, at that time in my life, I sort of began to feel like the impressions and the thoughts that I was receiving from, you know, what I call Jesus was along the lines that if I were to continue with Christianity, I would eventually, with conventional Christianity, I would eventually not be fed anymore, you know, that there wasn't going to be anything there for me. And that
right.
he was actually encouraging me to pursue Eastern religions.
Right.
And so one day I was just following, you know, the Spirit.
Yeah.
And I was at Harvard University. I think I was a graduate student at the time, but I did my undergraduate and my graduate school there.
In what field?
I was in cellular and developmental biology
uh-huh.
as an undergraduate, and then I was in biochemistry and molecular biology
uh-huh.
as a graduate student.
Uh-huh.
And somewhere around the cusp, I believe it actually was the second year of my graduate school, I was told, you know, just go walk and we'll guide you. And I was walking along, and I ran into the divinity school, and
uh-huh.
you know, I was asked to step in. I stepped in, and there in the conference hall was something going on. And it was actually, at the time I really didn't know what it was, but it was actually a Tibetan Lama who was
uh-huh.
giving meditation instructions to the Harvard Divinity School students.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sat down And everyone was following the teacher who had his eyes closed and was sitting cross-legged. And I had no idea what meditation was at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just sort of sat in my chair waiting for, the lecture to begin and just kept looking at my watch periodically because it looked to me, for all intents and purposes, that he was just resting.
Right.
And everyone else, seemed to be copying him. And I thought, well, this isn't very complicated, There isn't really anything sophisticated here. I mean, I can do this at home.
Right.
It's just, sitting down and closing your eyes. So after about, 20 minutes of nothing going on, because there was absolute silence, I just got up and decided, that was it, and thank you very much. And so I actually left the room and, and walked out. And I think Suryadas, because this Lama was one of the greatest Dzogchen masters of the last generation who was teaching. And he actually, turns out, was my Kagyu Lama's Dzogchen master. Or
was
Dzogchen
that Kalu teacher. Rinpoche? Was that Kalu? No. Who was
that? Well, my Kagyu master is Kalu Rinpoche's nephew.
Ah, okay.
And it was actually Kalu Rinpoche who asked me to study with his nephew. In a vision,
In the vision before this meditation? No. Walk out of the room at the Harvard Divinity School and some
Harvard Divinity, at Harvard I was, praying and meditating and chanting for about 4 hours a day. To 5 hours a day.
But that first experience, you were about to leave, and then Suryadas, was he in the audience there and asked you to stay? What happened?
Suryadas handed me a pamphlet on my way out, a brochure.
Uh-huh.
He said, thank you for coming, please take this, and look at it in your free time, You might find something there. And I took the brochure and I went my way.
Mm-hmm.
And within the next day or two, I think directly afterward, I just felt like going to the Harvard Co-op bookstore and looking through their Tibetan books. And I found a book actually that was edited by and it was called The Snow Lion's Turquoise Mane. And at that time, I didn't know it was Suryadas that I had met as I was in the meditation hall.
I get it.
And so, the Snow Lion's Turquoise Mane was a book on Tibetan folk tales.
Uh-huh.
The kind of, stories you would read to children.
Right.
Perfect for my level because I was just being introduced to the Tibetan tradition. I have. And it gave me, this way to connect with it in a very simple, accessible way that I really, really enjoyed because it was just stories.
Right.
About different Tibetan saints and their lives and how they were able to do amazing things.
Who was the Tibetan guy that built the house and had to tear it down and that famous story? Milarepa. Right. He was a famous saint. So anyway, you start to get exposed to Tibetan culture and get more into the meditation. And then did you start to become initiated into a particular tradition?
That's right. When I came back from Harvard to California, I stumbled into a local bookstore in L.A.
Is that the Bodhi Tree?
The Bodhi Tree.
Yeah.
And there were flyers in the Bodhi Tree advertising Orjen Kusum Lingpa, giving a cycle of empowerments and teachings in Brentwood.
Uh-huh.
And so I drove over to Brentwood and sat down, I sat down behind Oliver Stone in the audience.
Director, yes.
Yes, the director, Natural Born Killers, and
right.
I felt this was all very strangely familiar. The sounds, the music, the horns, the bells, the drums, the chanting. And I, more than anything else, I just liked the music and the colors. It was a very sort of aesthetic, you know, superficial. Superficial is what I call it. I was mostly drawn by its aesthetics.
The beauty of it.
I had a very, the beauty of it. That somehow it seemed, you know, like very, very familiar.
Uh-huh.
And I remember, you know, during the empowerment, I understood what all the symbols were. Like when you, when empowerments go on, they're actually, they don't explain what's going on, but they do, they use all these symbolic ritual implements and they show you things. And I spent the whole time analyzing, okay, this one means this. And okay, now they're showing us this because it's, they're trying to guide us along this way and they're trying to teach us this thing, you know, and I was just able to roll with all of it and figured, you know, it was all very kind of clear. And I wondered to myself if anyone else sort of was picking up on what it all meant.
And did you ever figure out that that perhaps you were part of that in a past life or something? Is that what came to you eventually about that familiar?
Eventually, you know, I realized that in my last life I was a Tibetan.
Yeah.
You know, and that I was a Kampa in eastern Tibet. And that I had died trying to defend Tibet from the Chinese invasion. But before that, I had had several lifetimes in Tibet, some of them as lamas, you know. So then I, you know, began to realize, you know, that Tibet is a fairly recent, you know, connection for me. In terms of my lifetimes, I've had lifetimes in other parts of the world.
How did you remember all these lifetimes? How did you get into that?
I think, you know, some of them were told to me by my teachers. Some of them, you know, were like intense emotional reactions, you know, to certain triggers visually. Some of them, you know, came in the form of, you know, my particular, I guess, I sort of have a kind of clairsentience. In Chinese, it's called the cultivation of sensitivity or the sensitivity skill. And what it is sort of like information comes to you.
Right.
And you just know things.
I understand that totally. I get that too. So you studied a lot of Tibetan stuff, and then you got into your Chinese tradition too, then, because I'm really interested in the Taoist practices, the Kunlun, the fire water, all that whole phenomenon. Can you talk about then how did you get into the whole Chinese thing?
I really had to get into the Chinese thing because you know, what I've been sort of told, is that, you know, having been a lama in previous lifetimes, you know, I'm somewhat like of a tulku, somewhat of someone like a reincarnate. And
right.
So my training was, I had a lot of instincts, a lot of like, I knew where, how to practice and what I needed to focus on. But I was always feeling like the information wasn't adequate. So then in order to flesh out my understanding, I studied it, you know, as much as I could from the Indian Hindu and the Chinese Taoist traditions. And I found, you know, many of my answers, most of the answers that I was looking for in those two traditions, especially the Taoist.
Wait, so you studied the Tibetan Buddhist and then the Indian Hindu and then the Chinese Taoist. All three of those traditions, I mean, there's a lot that they have in common, but there's a lot that they very much don't have in common, and probably the subtleties in those teachings are very, not contradictory, but, you know, they're not harmonious in a sense, or did you find you were able to kind of pick a spirituality out of all those traditions and make it work for you?
Absolutely.
But can you talk about the differences between the Hindu, the Buddhist, the Taoist, and what you got from each of those?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, that's what I'm interested in.
They're all working with the same substrate, meaning the energy body or the spiritual body. You know, you could think of it as a circuit. There's a certain, like, electrical circuit, if you may, in the human body. And each of them really work with the same system, but they have different portals of entry, different points of access, and in some sense, you know, they have different sacred numerics that they're working with.
Yeah, because...
because
they're sort of... I mean, chakras and then nadis and acupuncture points are very different elements. I mean, it's subtle. I don't think prana is the same thing as chi or what type of chi, but maybe it is. I mean, there's these subtle differences, or are they different names for the same thing?
Well, you're right in the sense that each lineage, each tradition has its own energy.
Right.
It's almost like, you know, if you were to say, you know, the body is a reflection of the mind.
Yeah.
And the energy body is also a reflection of the mind. And so each tradition is almost like creating a kind of mental ladder to ascend the levels of a particular way of quote-unquote going up the mountain. But
right.
It's, you know, at its most absolute sense, it's ultimately just like a thought form, a convenient thought form that provisionally enables the seeker to work with the what's available from the tradition in a certain way, you know, because you're dealing with intersecting realities when you're dealing with, you know, human reality. And
right.
So when you look at the traditions, each of their energies are fairly unique.
They are very unique and very different realities and very different mindsets, actually, and different...
Absolutely.
And different beings inhabit, in a sense, different realms of the hierarchies that exist within those mystical traditions, right?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
But in a sense, you know, theoretically, you can garner a lot of understanding from a survey, because each of the traditions have varying degrees of secrecy regarding certain areas. Well, for example, Tibetans are outstanding at the cultivation of the heart-mind-spirit axis.
Mm-hmm.
So they're able to deal with, you know, sort of higher level, higher frequency, vibrational transformation than other traditions, and that's what they emphasize.
Uh-huh.
But because they emphasize states of mind so much, they don't really talk so much about the underlying energetic physiology as much as the other traditions. I mean, they certainly have very sophisticated energy systems, but their goal isn't so much those energy systems as getting lost in those meditative states.
Right.
The Taoists, you know, and if you just look at acupuncture as an outgrowth of Taoism, you can see how sophisticated their knowledge is of the, you know, human energy system.
Right.
So,
I totally hear that, and that's interesting distinction among, you know, Tibetan Buddhism and Chinese Taoists, is that the Chinese, that tradition valued the body and the wisdom of the body and being part of nature. You know, Taoists say the nature is inside of us. You know, we all contain the whole world, and we are in the world. And then where does the Hindus fit in that, the Hindu, Indian Hindu philosophy that you studied?
I think that the Hindus are, you know, fairly close to the Taoists in many respects. You know, if you look at yoga, of course, yoga is not all of Hinduism. There's so many schools and, you know,
right.
traditions. And primarily I concerned myself with the Siddha traditions.
Uh-huh.
So the traditions of enclaves of practitioners who were generally reclusive and yet achieved miraculous power. So the Siddha traditions and the alchemical traditions of India, Tibet, and China, you're talking about Taoist immortals, you're talking about the Agoras, the Nath Sampradaya, you know, the Hindu Tantrikas or Kapalikas, you know, some of the Kashmir Shaivites, the Kala tradition, Pratyabhijna, and then, you know, a little bit of Advaita Vedanta. In the
Chinese tradition.
In the Tibetans, you know, mostly the 84 Mahasiddhas. And of course, you know, 9 of the 84 Buddhist Mahasiddhas are not yogis. So they're counted both in the Hindu list of the 84 Mahasiddhas and the Buddhist list of the Mahasiddhas. So the founders of yoga, you know, are inspirations to practitioners of both Siddha or Tantric traditions. And with the philosophical differences, I see, you know, Buddhism as having borrowed heavily from Hinduism, both in technique and some praxis. It has some of its own individual unique techniques. But if you look at yantras and you look at the Vedic influences for puja and fire rituals and the general deity yoga, there's really, I think, you can see lots and lots of scholastic and evidence for Buddhists really borrowing a lot from their Hindu counterparts. And back then, I think the Siddhas were very non-sectarian, that they intermingled quite freely, you know, competing sometimes sharing techniques, you know. There are some great Sri Vidya masters in Tibet who have both Tibetan disciples as well as their own Hindu disciples.
But talk about the magical parts of that. I mean, what we would consider magical. I mean, the cities, the abilities that people have achieved, whether, you know, they were Kashmir Shaivites or, you know, high esoteric lamas. I mean, talk about that, because people aren't really familiar. And I know this stuff is true. I mean, but what have you seen and what have you discovered is possible?
What I've discovered as possible is the phenomena called, I guess, breatharianism in modern parlance, or embryonic breathing or fetal breathing. Which isn't a city per se, but it's the gateway to city in both the Indian tantric tradition, in the Taoist tradition, and very much so in the Kalachakra tradition of Tibet. You know, you especially hear mention of it in the pith instructions of the Janang school, one of the schools that was suppressed at the time of the great fifth Dalai Lama and you know, assimilated into the Gelug school.
Oh, is that the Dorje Suchin stuff?
No, that's the Kalachakra, is the Wheel of Time teaching, which of all the Tibetan teachings bears the closest resemblance to the Hindu, you know, Hindu tantric teachings. And
so the embryonic breathing is a way to disconnect from eating food or needing food to live?
It's which is a side effect of not having to breathe, essentially. In meditation, you know, you hear about these yogis that they seal underground in caskets, then they open it up and they're still alive, or you know, they meditate underwater for hours at a time.
What's the secret to that? How is that possible? I mean, what do they do?
Essentially, in the Taoist tradition, they basically say that the one key that opens all the doors is enlightening the the third eye chakra. They don't use those terms, but that's probably what people are more familiar with.
They call it Tiananmen Heaven Eye. Is that what they call the Chinese? Call the third eye the Heaven Eye?
The third eye chakra, with regards to vision, one of the manifestations is the Heaven Eye, Heavenly Eye.
Or it's actually the pituitary gland, actually physiologically, isn't it?
That's the structure, the physical structure that's close to that energetic, region that you're trying to stimulate.
Okay. And so they activate that with a certain technique that then means we don't have to breathe in order to live. I mean, how does that work? If you wanted to
say... Essentially, when you were a baby, you were not using your lungs. If you look at the matter, I learned this in medical school, the lungs themselves are sort of deflated and pretty much filled with fluid.
In the womb, right?
There's a circulation system of the amniotic fluid, which is the fluid in the amniotic sac that buffers the baby. This fluid the baby swallows and goes through the digestive tract, and so it actually enters into the fetus. But the fetus's lungs are not expanded because there's no air. It's just a completely fluid environment. So for that reason, the lungs are deflated, and they're also filled with fluid. It isn't until you're born when all that fluid has to drain from the baby's, nose and mouth, that it takes its first gasp of air.
Uh-huh.
And what happens when a baby takes that first gasp? It cries.
Uh-huh.
It cries because of the pain of a switchover in terms of its energetic and spiritual circuitry. Because in the womb, the baby is still what the Taoists call prenatal.
Right.
It's still possessing its original nature. Lao Tzu said, can you revert to a baby, to be as supple, as a baby is supple. And essentially, the Taoist practice and the Buddhist practice, and I would say even the Indian Hindu practice based upon my study of Tirumular's Tirumandaram in South India, is that we have, when we become born into this world, a split in our psyche, in our energetic selves, in our spiritual selves, that sends us down the pathway of mortality, sends us down the pathway of entropy, where we
That's the postnatal cycle. That's the post-creation cycle in the five elements.
That is the postnatal cycle.
Right.
And when you look at the ancients, whether of China, India, or Tibet, they had really profound, practical, workable knowledge regarding this process and the way to reverse it. You know, and it is actually very much a science, because if you can get a hold of the pith instructions, they lay out step by step, and not only the methodology, but the underlying theory, and theory and reasons why one proceeds in that manner, because of the energetic, separations and the way to reunite them, as you were talking about fire and water, Khan and Lee,
right.
Life and mind. It's really sort of like the light switch was turned off. And if you know how to flip the light switch back on, there's suddenly light.
So entropy...
You never know.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, you never know what? Go ahead.
If you never know how to... that there is a light switch, and that it was flipped off, then you'll never be able to flip it back on.
So I was just thinking, in postnatal sequences, water creates wood, creates fire, creates earth, it creates matter. Now, if we reverse into the other way, then we have water creating metal, creating earth, creating fire, and we're kind of moving backwards into nature itself. We're we're reversing entropy.
Which the Hindus called Laya Yoga, or reabsorption union, the union by dissolution, the union by reabsorption. So you reverse the creation cycle, which the Buddhists call the generation cycle, and the reabsorption or dissolution cycle they call completion cycle. So as the five elements are reintegrated and merged into primordial emptiness, into the Wu Ji, you are able to reconnect with your original, you know, spiritual source, who you are, or, you know, your original nature. And then that is self-aware, self-intelligent, and is able to guide your progress naturally, meditation. Embryonic breathing doesn't occur really through any force of intention. It occurs naturally as a side effect of the reactivation of your prenatal nature and circuitry.
And how do we do that? How do we reactivate our prenatal nature? Because we do have it in us.
Each tradition, you know, has a different, let's say, different way. You know, if you metaphorically take this problem as scaling a mountain, then some traditions choose to pitch their base camp lower and then go from the left, others go from the center, others go from the right. If I were to speak from my own experience with regards to the, you know, my combination of, to, you know, let's say it this way. The key point, as, you know, from my understanding of the Taoists and in my experience, is to activate the third chakra functionally. You know, not so much visually, although there are luminescent manifestations that occur naturally. But you have to activate the third eye chakra in a certain way.
Uh-huh.
When you stimulate it in a certain way, you know, it will proceed naturally on its own. Now, to answer your question, the Buddhist way, which is, you know, the way I did it and the way I, you know, my experience and my understanding of it, is essentially based on this idea that for most people, the central channel is closed. There
the Chang, the Chang Mai, is that what you call the central channel, or is it the Hindu central channel, or which central channel and which tradition are you talking?
You know, Jerry Allen Johnson calls it the Tai Chi pole, and the Chong Mai in TCM, in acupuncture, is usually a little bit lateral from the Tai Chi pole. But, you know, sometimes in Chinese, actually, central channel is Zhong Mai. So,
but
you know.
But we say it goes from the perineum to the top of the head. Is that the central
channel?
That's
right.
Okay.
That's right. Now, it changes position. Initially, it is the sushumna, and it sort of curves along the spine, in front of the spine. Now, in most people, it's closed or it's constricted where the left and right sun and moon channels curve and twist around it. And so at those crossing points, you know, there's the central channels pinched off.
Wow.
But in a meditation...
Go ahead. Yeah.
In a practitioner who meditates and is able to activate the upper, you know, third... let's call it the third eye chakra in that way, this channel now moves, almost begins to straighten itself so that it moves forward so that it can go straight up and down. You know, that's why sitting straight up and down is so important. And then as it, you know, re-corrects its positioning, you're able to do the energetic transformations that, you know, allow the cities to then, you know, progress and occur.
Do you need to be initiated, though, for that, or is that something everyone has within them to activate on their own?
Yeah, different traditions, you know, couch the solution in different ways. For example, if you look at the kahunas of Hawaii, they you know, you're really interacting with the, you know, the fundamental ground of being, which is, you know, undifferentiated, you know, complete unity.
Mm-hmm.
So whichever aspect you choose to hook into, which is what each tradition chooses, is really just a facet of the same diamond. Now, the kahunas, you know, were appealing to their higher self. And what they would do is, they had a particular lineage they drew power from. That lineage was their ancestors. So they made sure that they could remember the names of all their ancestors, you know, however many generations back, and they would retain this knowledge orally, you know, so that when they were invoking power, they could invoke, you know, let's say from the Akashic records, they could, you know, use the cords between them and their ancestors to funnel energy
right.
to their upper third eye chakra, to their third eye chakra. So,
yeah.
And they would appeal to their higher self to send energy there. So for them, they may have had their own lineage of kahunas, you know, but they chose to phrase and frame the problem in terms of their higher selves. Whereas in Tibetan Buddhism, you know, we work with the either the founder of the lineage or a specific protector, a current incarnation or the lord of the entire school or the lineage itself or our own root master, you know. And but really, you know, when you look at, say, the teachings of the autobiography of Yeshe Sogyo, she said very directly to her students, although you may call to me, it is great space that responds to you.
Right, right. So in the Toltec tradition, they call it the infinite source, and that same Toltec, and you know, that same quality. But, yeah, go ahead.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So that's what I've been interested in, is sort of understanding the, you know, universal process or the, you know, how this works from in a universal way, although it's tradition specific as far as how I do it. You know, if I understand it only within my tradition, then I just propagate a dogma, or you know, I'm not able to step out of the box and really understand it.
Well, that's
because
what's so valuable about what you've done and looked at so many different traditions. It's not actually a tradition at all. It's a basic human capacity, is what you're saying, right?
It is the fundamental, most important capacity of every human being, because we're on this journey to rediscover ourselves.
Right.
But you know, this is a physical world, and knowledge is, you know, you only get knowledge through certain channels. You know, this knowledge is not available in the public domain, and it's not, you know, out there in any significant way without the, you know, either an exhaustive study or you know, the benefit of some really outstanding teachers who are willing to impart the information to you.
Well, you're going to be teaching something this weekend in New York, right? You're going to be teaching this method?
Yes. I'm going to be teaching embryonic breathing, the theory, and an introduction to the practice
TRS, right? Yeah.
Yeah, all day, I think, sort of 9 to 5.
Saturday the 10th? Is it Saturday?
Yeah, it's Saturday the 10th. Mm-hmm.
It's TRS at 44 East 32nd Street in Manhattan. And should they call your number? Who should they call if they want to take the course?
Well, they can call Sri. They can call Jeanette.
Okay.
Jeanette told you Saturday as opposed to Sunday.
I think so. You mean Shakti, Sri Shakti, that person?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
Is there a website, or you should wait? I can have people call me, or should I give her number? Or
Or they can call my cell phone.
Okay, maybe you should give your cell phone.
Okay.
Give people your cell phone number in case.
Sure.
What is it? It's
808.
Yeah.
499.
Yeah.
9146. And they can email World Unity Center, that's WORLD, UNITYCTR, at yahoo.com.
Okay.
And World Unity Center is the nonprofit organization that is hosting and organizing my workshops in New York City.
And you're only doing that one? I mean, will you be back in New York at some point to do more?
I can. You know, I recently did a full-day workshop on this for my Dalit students in the area. And I'm basically here, you know, for 2 weeks. So traditionally how I've done this is by demand. You know, I teach in Hawaii, and there has, you know, been regular demand, and so
you'll be here in New York for another 2 weeks then?
I'll be here for another 2 weeks.
Because I'd like to continue the interview. I mean, we still have a little more time. I have some other questions I do want to ask you, but I just wanted to get that information out there for people
I think it's actually Sunday, okay?
Oh, is it Sunday the 11th then? Okay.
I think it's Sunday. Yeah, and it'll be during the daytime.
Okay.
And they can contact Sri Shakti.
Or they can contact me at 212-473-6388, 212-473-6388. I'll get the information out to people, or your number that you just gave, right?
Sure.
What I wanted to ask you, and hopefully maybe you could come down to my television station. We'll do like a sit-down interview for my cable show. So you were a biology student, and then you started to encounter these real esoteric traditions, and then you started to encounter in each of these traditions this understanding of immortality or the rainbow body or ascension.
Yes.
Or whatever you want to call it. How did that affect your biological, you know, foundation? What was that conflict that, and how did you resolve that?
You know, I wanted to look at that very closely, because once I had experienced embryonic breathing, being a scientist to my nature, and I just really wanted to reconcile how the mechanism. I've always been interested in mechanisms.
Yeah.
And so I looked at the generation of energy in the human body. Mm-hmm. and looked at it with reference to my own experience. And drawing from my experience, you know, when you actually activate that center in the head, a lot of other channels open up. And you become highly electromagnetic.
Uh-huh.
You actually feel like in an electromagnetic dynamo. And so you are assimilating and absorbing an enormous amount of energy, and you're also generating an enormous amount of energy, which is why, you know, people usually get healed when they're around high-level adepts or practitioners.
Uh-huh.
So when I looked at the process of generating energy in the body, I naturally looked at the mitochondria, which is a subcellular organelle that is responsible for making the energy currency of the body, ATP.
Uh-huh. Yes.
So if you actually look at mitochondria, it's an electrical circuit.
Right.
There is an electron transport chain, which is a bunch of proteins that shuttle various electrons, you know, down a voltage gradient.
Uh-huh.
to oxygen. Oxygen, the reason why you need oxygen is that it's the terminal acceptor. It's sort of a low energy state acceptor of electrons. If you don't have a catcher's mitt at the end of the chain, how are you going to catch the baseball?
So you need oxygen to generate the electricity, but if you're already generating the electricity some other way, you're saying you don't need oxygen. Is that...
That's right. And actually, there are non-oxygen-dependent redox mechanisms for running the electron transport chain in mitochondria that they discuss in biochemistry. It's just that that's not well known, you know, amongst the general, I guess, lay population. But that's what you're doing.
Wow.
You're running the electron transport chain independent of oxygen.
So you found an explanation then for this embryonic breathing
Absolutely, because you don't need oxygen. What you need is ATP.
Uh-huh.
Oxygen is just the key element in, let's say, the postnatal circuit in phosphorylating, you know, ADP into ATP.
So then my last question is, you do believe that the body can turn into light, photosynthesis, and then we can actually live forever in this body or transmute it. That's also a possibility, right?
Well, I'll tell you what I've seen is I had one master that, you couldn't see the lower half of her body, a phenomenon I call phase shifting. And then the grand master of my master's tradition in Tibetan Buddhism also part of his body became transparent. And that's a phenomena that occurs when the light is just so. The sunlight has to be angled in such a way that it actually interacts with the molecules.
And that's something you saw yourself, huh?
Mm-hmm. This is what people don't understand about alchemy, internal alchemy, is that you're actually changing sort of atoms and molecules at a subatomic level.
Wow. Hey, Oscar, I hate to stop at this point because it's just really, really getting interesting, but they're going to cut us off. But can we pick up this conversation maybe on television at some point or another interview?
Sure, we could do another interview, TV interview.
Because this is the kind of stuff I really want to talk to, this alchemy. And I just got text message that your workshop is on Sunday at TRS, that's 44 East 32nd Street. And I've been talking to Oscar Su, H-S-U. And your website again is, what was it?
You can see my Taoist teacher at www.kunlunbliss.com, KUNLUNBLISS.com. Mm-hmm. And I am one of his authorized teachers and transmitters,
mm-hmm.
Also building a retreat center in the Big Island of Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
So he is training me what he knows so that I can be the retreat master and, do what he does for the people that come for retreat. So that's www.kunlunbliss.com.
And if people do this workshop on Sunday, then they will learn embryonic breathing and start to kind of build an immortal body, as they call it in some traditions?
Well, essentially, I will be as, transparent as I can. In general, people need to understand that it requires, a significant, a very significant commitment on their part, because it's really one thing to understand how to do something, you still have to go do it. But I will essentially try to give them the fishing pole and the line and the hook so that they can fish for themselves. And then, you know, whether they achieve it is really up to them. But I will try to bridge that gap of knowledge that is not bridged, you know, at the current time.
Thank you, Oscar. I really appreciate your perspective because you're a real student of spiritual teachings, and not many people have taken that much time to compare teachings, especially the alchemical, esoteric, immortal teachings from the three great Eastern traditions. I mean, it's fantastic. And plus, your biological background really puts it into a whole new perspective. So, thank you.
Anytime.
Thank you
for, you're welcome.
And I'll be in touch with you, and I'll let people know where to find you and all that. And I just want to say this has been New Realities with Alan Steinfeld. If you want to reach me, you can call me at 212-473-6388 about this talk or this workshop coming up or anything else. Or you can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Or check my website for events in and around New York and the world at newrealities.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Oscar. I really appreciate it, and I'll be in touch with you.
Okay. Cool. Thank you, Alan.
Thanks.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.